Jugcast, July 2025 edition, with Phoebe Ryder, Louisa Mason, and Jamie Inslee. Hello and welcome to the Jugcast. I'm Phoebe, and it's just me in the studio again today. In this month's episode, we interview Dr. Mel Ifran about her research adapting machine learning techniques from radio astronomy to detecting cancer cells. We also answer some of your questions from our live event last month. Unfortunately, the audio we recorded from this event was very poor and did not pick up on any of the speakers, so sadly, we're not going to be able to share this with you. These are just teething problems though, and we hope to get them fixed for our next live event, so watch this space. Also, we want to hear from you. This month we will be conducting our next listener's feedback form. The survey will only take about 5 minutes and your responses will be invaluable in shaping the Jugcast. We love to hear your feedback and suggestions. The link to the survey can be found on our social media or on the Jugcast website. But now, the news. Seeing the dark side of the sun. This month, the European Space Agency's Solar Orbiter spacecraft has provided humanity with the first ever images of the sun's south pole. These images and videos reveal a shimmering, bright atmosphere strewn with complex, dark, cloud-like structures writhing about within, with temperatures ranging between 100,000 to a million degrees Celsius. These observations will shed light on how the sun cycles between turbulent active phases and quieter periods on its 11-year cycle. By closely studying the magnetic structures at the poles, researchers aim to better understand how these cycles originate and evolve. This knowledge is crucial for predicting future solar activity and improving models of solar dynamics. These predictions will help to inform plans to mitigate the impact of solar activity on our satellites and astronauts in space, as well as the power grid on Earth. To be a star or to not be a star? That is the question. The James Webb Space Telescope has been discovering new objects left, right and centre, and this month is no different. 9 new brown dwarfs have been identified, and among these, the lightest brown dwarf ever has been found, with a mass just 2 times that of Jupiter. This has been found in the Perseus Molecular Cloud, about 1,000 light-years away. The previous lower limit was 13 Jupiter masses. These mysterious objects push the boundary of what can be formed via stellar processes and blur the line between planet and star. They form like stars, with a collapsing cloud of gas and dust, but lack the mass required to trigger fusion of hydrogen to helium in their core and thus become a main sequence star. Spectroscopic analysis of these brown dwarf atmospheres shows a presence of an unidentified hydrocarbon. This unexpected find has only been seen in Saturn and Titan's atmospheres before and has led to the proposal of a new spectral class to classify these objects. And highlighted the need to rethink the models we have for brown dwarf atmospheres. Next up, Jamie and Louisa chat to Dr. Mel Ifran about her work on synchrotron modelling for the SKA and Meerkat, and now applying machine learning and image segmentation methods to detecting cancer cells. Mel is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Cambridge, but also did her PhD here at Manchester. We discuss what she's been able to transfer between the fields and what has surprised her most about working in a new area of physics.
Hello, we're here today with Dr. Mel Ifran. She's a postdoctoral research associate at the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge. She's using image segmentation and machine learning techniques to look at cancer cells and synchrotron radiation.
What does that mean? I suppose that's the first question.
Take it away.
I was trained as a radio astronomer. I actually got my PhD here in Manchester. So I learned a lot of data reduction techniques. I learned all of my sort of initial coding, got up to scratch with using image processing, forming data reduction pipelines. Really, I started out here on a project called CBAS. And it was amazing. There was a group of about 15, 20 of us. The guys that I worked with, they built the receiver, they then, you know, put it, assembled it, took the data, built all the data reduction pipelines from scratch. And so that gave me my introduction to data processing and to handling. Probably wasn't that large data at the time. Overall, it will become big data, but from CBAS, it wasn't necessarily big data, but it was about reading in numbers from an equipment and trying to do science with those numbers. And I think that's a very useful and very transferable skill. So now as I've gone on in my career, obviously I understand that the instrument doesn't have to be a telescope. It could be a microscope. Those numbers don't have to correspond to something in our solar system, in our galaxy, in our universe. It could correspond to something much more localized. Like, so what I look at now is tissue samples. So again, you're looking at intensity. It's the strength of the image, but that image is showing you cells that have been radiated with different antibodies. So different things are showing up. You're looking at different kinds of cells. But really just the introduction to, here's a piece of equipment. It has a job to do. These are the results that you get. The results need processing. They need, you know, they need you to understand how to take it out of the equipment and how to convert it into physical units that represent something. And then you have a particular science question that you want to answer. Like that was the training that I got out of Manchester. And then I applied it for astrophysics purposes up until the last year and a half, where I've been using it for medical imaging, which is, it's been really interesting, incredibly interesting.
Speaking of seabass, it's the logo is the little fish
with the galaxy,
goldfish.
Yeah. Going through. And the thing is, loads of people get, they used to come up to me and be like, yeah, but you know, that fish isn't a sea bass, but because it has like some spikes and some shapes to it. They're like, you know, that fish is actually more. I'm like, don't focus on the fish. I've given a 10-minute talk about.
I've played Animal Crossing. I know what a sea bass looks like.
Yeah. So people get really into the, like, it is important. It is important in life to have a good looking logo and a catchy name. That I will tell you.
In astronomy, the acronyms and the logo is very, very important to a survey.
Yeah.
It can have like almost like a cult following.
There should be part of your funding form where it says how much of your working hours did you spend trying to think of a cool name for something. Yeah. Because that's an overlooked and very important part of our job.
Yeah.
Fancy names.
I know you've done a lot of work on Meerkat. Would you be happy to tell us about your work?
Yeah, so the previous postdoc position that I came from, so I'd started it in 2020 remotely because it was COVID and nobody could start anything physically. And I was out in Cape Town. It should have been 3 years, but I was actually out there for 2 years. And I was working on an SKA precursor called Meerkat. So the SKA, this massive, like mammoth, impressive radio astronomy feat that is taking off, which will consist of dishes that are in Australia, but also dishes that are in South Africa. As the various antennas and the dishes slowly turn on and they start to get commissioned and they start to take science quality data, they're called precursor experiments. So the full array will be hundreds and hundreds of telescopes working as an interferometric array. But where I was in South Africa, about 64 of these dishes had been switched on. And they were starting to be used for a whole host of science projects. And the variety is absolutely immense. So the dishes are normally used as an interferometric array. So you normally have 64 dishes and they operate in unison and you have the cross correlations of the signals that are seen between those dishes. And they give you a really, really high resolution image on the sky so you can make out other galaxies outside of our own. Our project and the project I worked on called Meerklass decided to say, no, we're not going to use the telescope array as it was designed to be used. We're going to use each dish as a standalone single dish radio experiment. So my PhD had been working on a single dish experiment. Meerklass said, no, we're going to have 64. We're going to run 64 single dish experiments simultaneously at the same time. And the way that we're going to stack the signal is not as an interferometer. We're going to say that they're individual experiments, but they observe at the same frequency and they look at the same part of the sky, and we will average them all together. So you get really high signal to noise, but it's actually quite a large scale blurry view of the sky as opposed to an interferometer, which can really resolve out detail. And that's typically why it was a cosmology experiment. So unless you're doing something like galaxy surveys, so that you can look at the distribution of matter in the universe but just by measuring all and seeing all of the galaxies out there, a nice cheat thing to do is to look at a large area of the sky in a very quick, blurry way. So just to sum up all the emissions that are coming from all the galaxies. And that's a quick way of doing cosmology. So experiments that look at the cosmic microwave background, they look at large areas of sky, and they try to do the whole sky by doing your measurement off Earth on a satellite. Meerklass, it was a 21-centimeter experiment. So the idea was that it wanted to measure neutral hydrogen in the universe. Neutral hydrogen undergoes the spin-flip electron transition. So it gives off emission at 21 centimetres at the source. But if you're displaced, if you're in a different area to that source, then the emission is going to get redshifted. So by measuring at different frequencies, you're seeing the neutral hydrogen that was lying around the universe at different times, essentially at different redshifts away from us. So it was a way of measuring all of that unresolved. So we couldn't pick out distinct galaxies, but you have an overall sort of blanket of neutral hydrogen that slowly fades away over time because the neutral hydrogen comes together to form your first ever stars, and stars go together to form galaxies, and the hydrogen gets ionized. So you almost have this blanket of hydrogen, and then holes start forming in it as the hydrogen is getting ionized, and your signal becomes less and less and less. So it was a really interesting project, and the dishes themselves, the SKA precursors, the Meerkat dishes, are very impressive. Like I said, so people do galaxy surveys with them. We had a cosmology survey going. People also look for transients, things like pulsars and transient radio bursts. The dishes, they are UHF and L-band and S-band. So you can go from 580 megahertz, I think, all the way up to about 3 gigahertz now. So just the sensitivity, the high signal to noise, the enormous frequency range that's being covered, and the enormously different science cases that different experiments use those dishes to do. It's really, really an impressive endeavour.
Few people I know who've been lucky enough to go see the dishes in person are always like, it is like astounding seeing them in person because they're just massive, apparently.
I was really upset. I never made it in person. And the scale. So never mind the scale of the actual universe or even the solar system. I can't get from one end of South Africa to the other. It absolutely blows my mind. So in my Suzuki Swift, I think, was my rental car, trying to get up from Cape Town and into the desert where the SKA was, I think it would have been about an 8-hour drive, and I didn't want to venture doing it alone.
Covered the whole UK in that. You could go from like Mousehole to like Inverness in probably 6 hours.
There is like a little a fancy little I want to say propeller aircraft that takes you from Cape Town if you're very important up to the telescopes, but it's mainly reserved for if you're doing engineering works, like if you need to be there for an important reason. I just wanted to sightsee. So the good thing about being able to play with any data means you can work on any data. However, it means you actually have you're not doing the actual technical maintenance of the equipment. So it means you have no need to fly out to where that fancy bit of equipment is. So no, people don't fly you out to telescopes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. So my next question, are you excited for the SKA?
Enormously. And I would claim it's here because I've seen data out of it and it's brilliant. But I mean, okay, yeah, the precursors are, like I said, up and running and doing spectacular science. So it's almost hard for me to imagine that the full scope of it, because there's so many different things you can do, and already we're getting some amazing results in. So just in terms of the cosmology, so I think Meerklass already measured, it's the cross-correlation power spectra for the 21 centimeter signal. So that is autocorrelation would be that we managed to see the signal ourselves, which means you have to look with just your own, inside of just your own data, and your own data is contaminated by whatever contaminants you have. Cross-correlation is when you're looking at a particular feature and another experiment is looking at the same feature, but they have different problems to you. So they're looking in a different way, which means they don't have the same contaminants. So what you can do is you can do a cross-correlation analysis, because the primary science goal is common, the contaminants are different. And so you share one important thing, and everything you disagree on can be ignored to the side anyway. So there was a cross-correlation detection made, which was really, really, really useful, really important. We also managed to look at the galaxy, and it was in frequency bands that have been rarely probed. So with amazing bits of equipment like this, to some extent, you have a primary science goal, but then you get so much out just by turning the equipment on. And already you're the first person to have turned a piece of equipment on at 900 megahertz and measured that area of the sky. That's a win. That's not a science goal. You're releasing data of a region of the sky at a frequency that no one has ever seen before. So the science that is to fall out from that, I mean, we would just make it publicly available and someone else will take it and do something amazing with it. It doesn't even need to be your primary science goal, but you get so much for the astronomy community as a whole, just in terms of legacy products, things that you can make publicly available that wasn't your primary science goal, but somebody else has something cool in mind to do with it. So just seeing the data switch on. And they also have those really high resolution. And so Meerkat, used in interferometric mode, has released these amazing pictures of the center of the galaxy. Have you seen them? So I think Ian Hayward had a paper out that had...
Is it the one where they've got... They put like a moon for scale.
It's all streaks. It looks like the most aggressive painting ever. It's all like streaks and spears and spikes coming out from the just so much action going on in the center. It's absolutely phenomenal. Like just the amount of different physical effects and the resolution that we see these things at now and the clarity is, yeah. I am very excited for the more that there is to come. Yeah.
I think I quite like the way that you touch on the fact that one person's contaminants that they're putting in the bin is another person's life's work and sources of interest. So
absolutely. So cosmologists are always trying to throw the galaxy away, and there's so much to know about our own galaxy and so much in the, you know, to understand our own magnetic field, to understand cosmic ray propagation. Also the synchrotron emission, it can be linked with some more exotic physics like dark matter annihilations. So people have used maps of synchrotron emission from Planck to talk about really exotic physics as well, that normally if you're working on a project and the primary science goal is to measure the CMB or is to measure 21 centimeter, you're just throwing away large chunks of the, you know, the data, not because you're being lazy about it, but because if you wanted to access it, then you would have to clean even more local stuff like radio frequency interference, ground effects. And so the clearest and easiest way to get to your science can be to throw everything away. But a lot of people are working on some very clever techniques that means you can have your cake and eat it. Basically, you get to do your galactic science and you get to do your cosmology at the same time. And that really is optimum because there's so much information and we all want to keep all of it. And sometimes we can't, but figuring out how to is, it's the goal of many of us researchers.
So what have been your favourite things about each area you've been working in? So astrophysics versus applying things you've learned in astrophysics to healthcare.
So I think when I started my PhD, and so the project that I worked on, like I said, it was much smaller scale. So we could go out to the dish, we could go out to Northern Seabass, we could climb in the dish, we could unscrew bits, we could lift up buckets of liquid nitrogen and hold it over our head with somebody else pointing a pot to the receiver at us. You know, it was a very hands-on experience. I am an observational cosmologist in that I very much do dealing with the data from the telescope. I myself don't know how to build a radio receiver, don't know how to get it working. There are many talented people out there that do that. But when you work on a small project, you get to stand next to these talented people and you get an introduction. And so I really liked that about my initial sort of career in astro, in that it was a small, very nurturing group where I got to see a lot of different people's expertise and I got to experience things that were beyond just the data processing. It was a very physical aspect to the project, in that you could help out with screwdrivers and in a tiny little cherry picker. And that was amazing. The next postdoc I did was with Jerome Boban at the CA in Saclay, and that was much more mathematical. So that it took a completely different turn. So then it wasn't data processing anymore, and it was learning these new techniques to do with wavelet transformations and sparsity. And my maths had been lacking in that respect when I got out there. And actually it was eye-opening in just a much more internal way. It was about the fact that all the data you need is in there somewhere when you read these numbers in. And it might not be obvious in the dimension you live in. So you might plot the data on a map and it's just a mishmash of different signals all on top of each other. And how do you pull that apart? And we just don't exist in the correct dimensions to view that. But maybe you Fourier transform the data, or maybe you wavelet transform the data, and suddenly those features become really apparent in the way that, you know, you have loads of sine waves all stuck on top of one another and you can't pick them apart. You do the Fourier transform and then boom, clearly you see all those peaks. And that was really exciting, because the fact that all the information you need is right there in front of you and you just have to change your perspective to access it, I was like, that's incredibly cool. So I loved that aspect of my postdoc. Then the next one, again, I was working on an SKA precursor, massive experiment. Do not try and stand in the middle of their dishes. They won't stand for that. Do not take a cherry picker or a screwdriver out there. These are enormous bits of equipment that hundreds of people want to use. And again, it was working across massive international collaborations, getting together with people that had completely different sort of science goals, and then seeing the possibility that could come out of such an impressively designed bit of equipment. And that was new to me. So everything was something new. And then finally, for this position, now that I'm working on biomedical imaging, I think you focus and you specialize so much, and you know, you truly love one thing and you're driven to, and, you know, many people will be working on something and they'll feel an immense amount of pride or passion for it. And then to step out of that and to look at somebody else's field, which is incredibly interesting and has a lot of things to inspire you and make you passionate, it's a really rejuvenating experience that you've been so focused on why one thing is super cool or really beautiful or the way to look at the world, and then you're introduced to a completely new set of people who are talented and dedicated and who have insights to show you. And the fact that it's accessible through technique and through maths, the fact that you have access to be able to talk to these brilliant experts that, you know, I wouldn't be able to go within a mile of with my biology information. It's not up to scratch at all. But the fact that you can convene around data processing and therefore learn new things about their field, I mean, that's spectacular in itself. That's a free education, which is super rare. And it means that you get to sit and you get to have these conversations, and you can add something to it as well from the point, because I think in biology, a lot of the PhD students, in the biologists, the chemists, they actually operate physical equipment. So in physics, we spend a lot of time. Most of my training was on software, and it was how to use a computer and how to code and stuff like that. So we're heavily entrenched in that. And some aspects of biology or biochemistry, it's done, but in alongside with being able to work in the wet lab, being able to operate these microscopes, being able to deal with tissue samples. So perhaps they won't have spent as long coding or doing software engineering as we do. So you get to, you know, you get to share and you get to discuss with them. Though saying that, if an actual software engineer came in, they'd blow us all out the water because they're completely focused on that. But just being able to sit down and talk with people who have all this expertise and all this passion, and the thing that brings you together in one room, and the thing that unifies you is the data. There's something really pleasing about that. And yeah, I'm learning a lot. And I'm now seeing analogies. I'm seeing new ways to imagine old information that I had in my brain, different ways to use it, different ways to access astronomy, which is very cool. Hopefully give me a little bit of a better understanding of how to process and understand other people's fields as well, but we'll see. Two fields at a time, let's say. Let's start with that. And then maybe a third after this.
It's quite nice that I guess you get to see the equipment in the flesh now rather than being like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
There's some telescopes somewhere.
Yeah.
And I work with them, but never seen them.
Haven't been in the same country, is it? Yeah.
Cool. Has there been any surprises that you've had since started working in healthcare? Is it a lot more similar than you thought? Or is there some things that really surprised you?
How close they are with people. So the goal of this is to improve the lives of human beings. The goal of this is to make better treatments, to have to resort to less evasive treatments, so maybe surgery can be avoided, but to also to really think how the decisions you're making are affecting other people. And to some extent, in physics and in simulations, you can push the boundaries of whatever you want to do, and that's really, really fun. But when you're trying to create a system that will impact people, you have to think about how it affects people, so that how close the people who work in this field are with actual patients. So they bring in patient advisors, they go to conferences, and in those conferences, people who have experienced part of their lives with cancer will talk about how the treatments impacted them, and they will discuss techniques as well. So for instance, if you come up with a cure, this is a silly example, but if you came up with a cure and it involved taking 10 pills every 5 seconds for the rest of your life, the human being cannot manage this. They're going to have to sleep. So unlike in the physical sciences, where to some extent we are learning about the world around us, we use whatever techniques we want in order to understand it, but the natural world is as it is. There is something a little bit more in this field of cancer research where you want to give back and you want to contribute, but you need to do that in a way that marries up with how society works, how people work, how they feel, how they move about their lives, how they recover, how they recuperate. You're trying to make the situation better for them. So that is absolutely everyone's primary focus. So everyone that I work with is really, really focused on trying to improve the lives of other people. And the conferences that I've been to, it has very personal, very moving accounts from people who have at some point in their lives had to deal with cancer, what they found helped, what they found didn't help, and how communication actually of the ideas and the research and the techniques that's being used is actually very important for patients as well, because they obviously have a supreme interest in understanding every single aspect of about what's going on with them, including machine learning algorithms that are being put in at whatever point of it. So an enormous amount of highly informed people that have personal experience as well. And that is something that I haven't had to consider the human or the social viewpoint a lot in astrophysics. I mean, obviously we do stuff like citizen science. We want to have open shared data and things like that. We do consider the society that we live in. It's just there isn't an individual human point of view on the synchrotron mission that's going around our galaxy, whereas obviously there is a very human point of view on the treatments they are used and when they are used for cancer research. And that shouldn't have surprised me, but it did. I wasn't aware of how embedded it is. It is incredibly important, and there's a lot of attention and a lot of care into how everything we do relates to actual patient usage.
That's so interesting.
Very often, like in astronomy, there's no ethical argument, really. Like there's maximum, you said before about maximizing the data that you get.
Yeah.
And I suppose that is the ethical question of maximizing the use for such a big computer burning all CO2. Besides that, there are very few fields that have anything to do, because you're looking outwards and you're not looking back at planet Earth. So very interesting to be able to think about those questions.
I guess we've covered this a little bit throughout the other questions, but is there anything you'd like to mention that you've been able to carry over from astrophysics to healthcare science?
Okay, so obviously there are techniques that we use that are transferable. So there are techniques that we use that aren't used, and there are techniques that we share. So component separation techniques like principal component analysis are shared across both fields, and machine learning shared across both fields. But there are ways that we process data, I think, that are a bit different. And I think we have touched on that. One of the interesting things that I found is that from an astrophysics point of view, obviously there is less of a concern about hurting a human being, because it's very rare that we have the ability to do that. So I find us much more gung-ho in our approach to trying out an analysis. So we're much more likely, or at least I'm much more likely, to give something a go randomly that makes no sense, but I wanted to try it. And I feel like that, you know, we're very open to exploration and it's not too big a deal. Whereas I've found that in the work that I'm doing now, there are sort of tried and tested approaches to things, because you know, at some level, depending on what you're doing, these things might need to go to review and actually get put into practice and used in society. And if it reaches that level, it has to be well understood, the process. So I think one of the useful things that we can offer is just sort of a bit more liberalism to do some odd things. And that has actually benefited. I find that's benefited my work. So obviously I showed up, and maybe that's true in any case where you show up in a situation where you're not grounded in that field, you haven't had that educational background, and so you get an idea of what's going on, and then you go home and you test out some of your own ideas and you go off in completely the wrong direction, in the opposite direction to everybody else in the room, because you haven't been trained in a way that everybody else in the room has been trained. But it means that you can come in with your slightly odd ideas that can't be put into practice for some reason, but parts of that, those odd ideas, are now new and they are useful and they can be fed back through. So that's been really helpful. So I have been in situations where I've got completely the wrong end of the stick, happily gone off on my own, because I'm trained as an astrophysicist and that's what we do. We go off into silence, into the night, to play around with bits of software that we're not worried about what impact it has. I've reappeared, you know, a day or two later with all this stuff, and some of it has been completely useless, because that's the process of innovation or discovery. But then some of it, people have been like, actually, that's not bad. We can try that. I don't think that's possibly anything to do with being an astrophysicist, or possibly anything to do with being around medical imaging work. I think it's just being from one field, being in one environment, stepping foot in a completely different environment, feeling free to try things out and bringing new ideas and seeing what sticks. And so that is nice. That's more than just the obvious technical stuff. There's approaches that mean as long as you're free to explore. And I think we are very free to explore in astro because we're not so worried about making mistakes. Whereas at least me, it depends on who you are as a person, but me, I'd be much more worried about wasting data if I thought it came from a person as opposed to out of a telescope, because you don't want to waste another human being's time if they've given you something. But yeah, so there is that sort of being used to playing and trying out odd ideas. But yeah, coming at it from a completely different approach and then realizing that even though you've said 99% nonsense, the 1% thing you said that wasn't silly has actually now opened up a new avenue. So like that's been quite cool and quite rewarding.
Would you recommend it then? Maybe trying a new
field?
A new field, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's been a really interesting, really rewarding time that I've spent. I've got like another couple of years at it, so it's not coming to an end yet, which is really, really nice. I think it has given me information that has improved my training in my own field, definitely. I think it's given me new information and new insights and new perspectives that I can take back to my own field. I hope that I have added something to the field that I'm working in. You'll have to ask them. But from my point of view, it has showed me new methods, but also given a change in perspective that I think, yeah, does stop you from getting such tunnel vision. So it's good to specialize, but it's also quite nice to stick your head up and look around, because many people are doing many inspirational things. And this has opened my eyes to just a lot more that's out there in the world. So yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Could I ask about to use machine learning in your work? And I don't think we've done anything on machine learning yet with the Jodcast. So would you be able to give us like a whistle stop, like a quick little brief masterclass on how you use the machine learning techniques? That have you applied it previously in astronomical images and now you're using it in your cancer research? Like a quick like little masterclass on machine learning. Easier said than done.
No, but the field is huge, so I can talk about the tiny little area that I sit in. So I sit, as far as the medical imaging goes, in something very specifically, which is computer vision. So you might have actually seen some papers or just some stuff online, because big companies like Meta, they will do computer vision is basically getting computers to be able to tell apart objects from images as well. So like I said, one of the big ones is telling apart cats from rabbits, but also, you know, if you have a picture of a person walking down a sidewalk in front of a lamppost, getting a computer technique to be able to pick out what is the lamppost and what is the human being and what's the person. And I say that they're quite popular, and that there, you know, there are blogs that will advise you on how to do this. Very large companies do it. You know, you just have to search a little bit around the internet if you're interested, and you'll see stuff on this. But that's the area that I sit in, and it's machine learning. So I use neural networks. So I use a particular form of algorithm, which is trying to understand the principal features of an image that it's given. And what it does is it looks at an image and it associates weights, or let's say a level of importance, to all of those features inside of that image. And it will process so that the networks have different layers that go across them, and the layers are really just refining this model of what are the important features in that image until you can boil down to the key things. So you want to be able to identify a human being. I mean, people are very different. They have different shaped noses. They might have some features like freckles. We've all got eyes that are very so slightly different sizes, but there's a general sort of, you've got a face and you know, you've got some eyes and a nose and a mouth. There's a general overall shape. So it's about picking out those key features. And so the algorithms that I use, at least for medical imaging, it's trying to pull out what are distinct cells. So we're literally talking about a circular shape, roughly. So you're just trying to pick out distinct different circular shapes in an image, and it's to save human beings from the time of having to do this. But also in a more detailed look, cells, again, they have slightly different patterns. So maybe their lymphocytes and their white blood cells, they're very small and very dense, very compact. Other different kinds of cells might be larger. So you can start feeding in information about cell size and cell areas. So then you have cell classification. So cell segmentation is just pick out all the different features, and then classification is try and learn and try and understand these features. And I use trained techniques. So the idea is you get a human being or something with some level of knowledge of what is the right answer, and you can train the algorithms to understand and to know this a bit better. So these are trained segmentation fitting models that I'm using. So that's where I sit in the sort of the big scheme of of artificial intelligence, and inside of that you have these machine learning algorithms, and I use very specifically neural networks.
Yeah, and it strikes me whenever you hear, like, I've seen a lot of these applications with astronomy, but it's less about the, in my very basic machine learning knowledge, but it's less about the computer. It's not an intelligence that you're creating. It's more a speeding up of the classification of things, because that would take many, many hours to go through the different, like, iterations, the different images you've got in astronomy, definitely.
Yeah.
I don't know about
in cancer research. It is model fitting, but it's training in a faster way than being able to just put in the statistics of this. But yes,
yeah.
It is. Yeah. And the idea is that you can use after you have dedicated, let's say, how many thousands of hours in your GPU resources to training a particular model to do something, what is nice is that it can then be shown, let's say, new information, but it's not new information really at all, because it's very, very strict in that if you have trained something to tell apart cats and rabbits, you can then ask that model to be able to fit either a cat or a rabbit. You can't show it a picture of a dog. But after you've done that, somebody with the exact same task can then use your network. So yeah. They don't have to train for hours and hours on top of that, which is very nice. So I know that obviously machine learning algorithms, they can be computationally costly. They can use an enormous amount of resource. But when you have a group of people with a similar problem, it's actually quite nice that they all don't have to go away and sort out the answer. They can then share across the weights or the fitting parameters that have been generated by one machine learning algorithm. So that is a nice thing that reduces the cost or the environmental cost of this. And that with machine learning algorithms, the knowledge is shareable. Under very specific circumstances, you've got to be asking the same question. And for image processing, you've got to have exactly the same image sizes as well, because the information corresponds to each of those pixels in the image. So you need the same amount of pixels. But that's the nice thing. You're training a model, and then you can share the information, like, across fields and across people, as long as it's the same kind of question that people are asking.
So thanks very much, Mel, for coming to Journal Bank.
It's been really fun.
Of astrophysics. Yeah.
Manchester.
Thank you for coming back to Manchester. And thank you for taking the time to speak with us today, because I know you're really quite in demand.
We had to drag you away. No, this has been a really, really nice experience. However, I can big up the Jodcast or advertise the Jodcast. It's super cool. I will tell everyone I meet about this, because it is excellent. Absolutely excellent.
Thank you very much.
This month, after hosting our Jodcast Live event at the Pint of Science Festival, we asked our audience what questions they have about the universe. Louisa has a go at answering some of them in this month's Ask an Astronomer segment. And don't forget to submit your questions for our next Ask an Astronomer. If you have never submitted a question before, now's the time to try. Your question may feature on the next Jodcast episode.
So, despite not being able to use the audio from our Jodcast Live evening, as part of the Pint of Science Festival, we still had lots of interesting questions set to us by the audience on the night. So for this month's Ask an Astronomer, I chose a couple of questions to answer on the podcast. One about messaging extraterrestrial life on another planet, and what it really takes to build a telescope, just in case you wanted to build your own observatory. So the first question is, how likely is it that the closest habitable exoplanet is just too far for us to make meaningful contact with? So I think there's a lot to unpack with this question, with such a rapidly expanding field as exoplanets is. The first exoplanet was detected in 1998, and there is still a lot to find out about all the different variety of planets that orbit other solar systems. If you're counting from NASA's exoplanet archive, NASA counts 5,921 confirmed planets as of June 2025. And the closest is a system of planets in orbit around Proxima Centauri. Now, the definition of a habitable planet remains the range of orbits around which liquid water could exist on that exoplanet's surface, nicknamed the Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold. Just right. The habitable zone is something that remains questionable in research, because scientists are starting to find other factors that are really necessary to create a stable home for life. Whether that's the planet's magnetosphere, or plate tectonics on the surface, or even the influence of a planet's rotational axis. And is water the only solvent that life could flourish from? that's when we get into the exciting worlds of ammonia or even sulfuric acid worlds. But getting back to the question, any form of messaging across the cosmos can quickly become a challenging endeavour. If extraterrestrials are using electromagnetic waves to message us with, then their messages can't travel faster than the speed of light. So as a result, for our local neighbour Proxima Centauri, messages sent via electromagnetic waves could take approximately 4 years to travel to reach us. Anyone eager for a two-way conversation has their hopes pinned on aliens on one of Centauri's exoplanets, because any further out and the messaging conversation gets longer and longer. But what constitutes meaningful contact? How much could we hope to understand from an alien message? How could we even begin to decode it? And would we be content with a simple, "we exist" from our alien neighbours? How much would you really want to know? There's certainly a lot to think about when it comes to considering extraterrestrial life, and I think the challenge is not about how likely the detection will be, but instead postulating the many different forms that alien life and their communication could take. So the next question asks, what are space-based telescopes and ground-based telescopes typically made of? So we use a variety of instruments to explore the universe, depending on what frequency of the electromagnetic spectrum we want to observe. And that largely depends on whether it can propagate through the atmosphere unaffected. So ground-based observatories tend to be for radio waves, whereas if you want to observe something like infrared, you need to get off the planet, above the atmosphere. So in terms of the materials used, the biggest factor for space-based telescopes is the weight, because whatever you're going to build needs to fold up neatly onto a rocket and send it into space. You also need to consider the extreme environment that your satellite's going to exist in. So whatever materials you use needs to cope with extreme temperatures so it doesn't expand and contract rapidly. What about cosmic bombardment? It's very critical. You're thinking about the electronics that are stored on board, and you can't repair these sorts of things once they're in space. And of course, there's other larger debris flying your way. In fact, some satellites now use Kevlar, that bulletproof material, to shield the precious parts of the telescopes and satellites' payload from flying debris, even on the International Space Station. So space-based telescopes are largely built from aluminium, with a little bit of gold, if we're thinking about the iconic James Webb Space Telescope and its foldable mirror. However, it's a completely different story for ground-based observatories. In space, you have to be compact and light. On the ground, you want the biggest telescope that you can build and afford. So radio observatories like the Mark 1 Lovell Dish at Jodrell Bank rely on steel to support the antenna's surface and avoid deforming under its own weight. The Dish has a mass of 1,500 tonnes. So in fact, some of the Mark 1's structure has been bought and reused from World War II battleships. So sturdy stuff. Occasionally, not sturdy enough. There have been incidents where radio telescopes get too big and collapse under their own weight or bow from wind. So it's a really tricky engineering problem to be able to create structures that will withstand the test of time, the test of gravity, and, of course, the weather. If you think about a different form of electromagnetic waves, the recently constructed Vera Rubin Observatory contains the world's largest camera. So we're not talking about an antenna dish, instead we're talking about giant lenses. And really, the observatory needs to build something to protect that from dust, from the elements, and from being degraded over time. What about the new SKA LOWE site in Australia, which consists of 131,000 2-metre wire antennas, which, if you've ever seen a picture of them, they've been nicknamed kind of coat hangers for their wire-like structure. So there's not a lot to them, but there's a huge construction cost for the SKA, thinking about the concrete pads that they're having to build these stations upon. The infrastructure to get out to the site. So it's not just about what you build your telescope of, but how you get that observatory functioning in some of the most inhospitable or challenging places on the planet. So it just depends what you really want to look at in the universe as to what you build and where you build your telescope and the challenges that that brings. So we have time for one more question. And the question relates to one of the talks we had at the Pint of Science, given by Dr. Phil Bull, on this new telescope called RINO. So the question is, why does the RINO telescope have a horn, accurately named, whereas previous cosmology telescopes look a bit like a table? So both telescopes are looking at the same frequency band. So why are there so many differently shaped telescopes to look for the same thing? Listeners of the podcast may remember the cover art from January's episode, this table-like structure used by Dr. Eloy de Lera Acedo, who we interviewed at the time, and others to probe the early universe at cosmic dawn, out in the Karoo Desert in South Africa. So if you can't remember, have a listen to the episode, cast your mind back to that cover art. Whereas Dr. Phil Bull's telescope, he's leading the construction out at Jodrell Bank to build RINO, a feed horn antenna that, for the purpose of your imagination, could be described like a giant funnel or a chimney pot sat on top of the telescope. So there is a third type of antenna that can look for 21 centimetre transitions, and that's in fact that wire antenna that we mentioned earlier, currently constructed for the SKA LOWE project. So despite their funky appearances, all of these receivers are largely the same across these projects. What differs is their beam pattern, or the shape that's constructed on top of the receiver. So that depends, that can influence what fraction of the sky they can observe and how well they can observe that. So the big benefit to a feed horn is that you can direct your attention to a particular patch of sky or achieve a high gain in this direction. So the gain is a technical term for how sensitive your telescope is in a particular direction. So we have many differently shaped instruments that are all trying to achieve the same job, just peering back into the earliest epochs of the universe. So thank you to the three questions we received from the Pint of Science audience, but we are very open to questions wherever they come from. So if you have a question in mind, about astronomy, about astrophysics, about telescopes, about anything at all, please send them in. You can send them to us on social media, you can email us, you can send an old-fashioned postcard, as they used to with the Jodcast episodes gone by. But we're very interested to hear your questions and get us thinking about different aspects of astronomy.
We always love hearing your feedback. So here's just a reminder that this month we are doing a listener feedback survey. Please find it on our website and fill it in. But remember, you can get in touch all the time via Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, or send us post. Links and details can be found on our website at www.jodcast.net. Thank you to Mel Ifran for the interview. The audio editors were Jamie Inslee, Jordan Norris, and George Bendo. The show editor was Louisa Mason. The producers were Lily Correa Magnus and Tobias Russell. Until next time, Jod on.